Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. The Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Colorado Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by Avadem Health, the makers of the TheraWorks Protect U-Pack.
For the past couple of years, I've been helping Vivage out with antibiotic stewardship at about a dozen nursing homes. Other than being one of the most thankless things I've ever done, nobody wants to hear from me. It has been really an interesting journey, and I thought, you know, as I typically hear this collective sigh when antibiotic stewardship is mentioned, what could be interesting for, you know, this group and relevant, and I think maybe help spark some of our motivation to do a better job with prescribing antibiotics. So antibiotic resistance is what I chose to talk about. I really just wanted to shine a spotlight on this area. You know, I think, and perhaps people know a lot more than I did before this, but, you know, I think it's something we know about. We know exists. We know it's existed for a long time, but we're not on the front lines, so we don't necessarily see this on a regular basis. So I thought I'd really just shine a light into this world right now to get an idea of how bad the problem really is with superbugs and what's happened to the antibiotic pipeline, and that antibiotic stewardship is one of the parts to help improve that whole process. So I think it's helpful to go back in time just a little bit and say, what was life like before antibiotics? So an estimated 2 to 6 million military personnel died from infections in World War I, including a bacterial infection causing tetanus. This is an agonizing, slow death, increasing paralysis, culminating in lockjaw. Tetanus, prior to this, was not that common. It had been seen, but in World War I, it seemed to explode, and there were thousands of cases of tetanus. And as I talk about here in a minute, Alexander Fleming was on the front lines of all that, trying to figure out what was going on. We also had tuberculosis, syphilis, pneumonia, whooping cough, all caused by aggressive bacteria that reproduced with extraordinary speed and led to serious illness and often death. So surgery mortality rates, or whatever the version of surgery was at the time, were approximately 70% higher before antibiotics. Maternal mortality rates were approximately 60% higher before antibiotics. And this is definitely one of the components of our extended lifespan as a result of antibiotics. Before antibiotics, 90% of children with bacterial meningitis died. Among those children who lived, most had severe and lasting disabilities, from deafness to mental retardation. Strep throat was at times fatal. Ear infections would sometimes spread from the ear to the brain. And then just simple cuts, puncture wounds. Even a small infection can turn into a bloodborne infection, and their most common treatment for that was to cut off the limb. And that was the only way to save a lot of people prior to this, prior to antibiotics. So Alexander Fleming comes along. He's on the front lines in World War I, trying to figure out what's causing all the tetanus. He has a happy accident known as penicillin, 1928. The interesting thing is it took about a decade after the initial discovery of penicillin to really figure out what it could do, and then mass produce it and get it out for treating infections. The other neat thing I like about Fleming is that at the time, he also discovered very early that bacteria developed antibiotic resistance whenever too little penicillin was used or when it was used for too short a period. So this quote from Fleming, "The microbes are educated to resist penicillin, and a host of penicillin-fast organisms is bred out. In such cases, the thoughtless person playing with penicillin is morally responsible for the death of the man who finally succumbs to infection with penicillin-resistant organism. I hope this evil can be averted." I think he would have been a better antibiotic steward than I am. So in addition to, you know, basically discovering the first antibiotic, he was also one of the first antibiotic stewards, recognizing that bacterial resistance developed right away. So we have this golden era of antibiotics in the 1950s. The triumph of penicillin streamlined the productions of dozens of new antibiotics during the 50s. In fact, half of the drugs that are used today were actually discovered during this decade. Antibiotics are omnipresent in nature, but never before had we been exposed to mass production and use of antibiotics. So antibiotics are a result of this a huge microbiome that's under our feet in the soil, it's in our body, trillions of bacteria that are waging warfare all the time. And so in that warfare, they selectively choose basically the antibiotics that survive, the bacteria that survive have the best forms of survival skills, the survival of the fittest. And so there's natural antibiotics all the time that appear in nature. But when antibiotics were developed on a mass scale and exposed to the public, it's the first time that we had this sort of targeted, blanketed approach to our microbiome, where we were just pummeling our microbiome over and over again. And by the 1953, US was spending about $100 million a year on antibiotics. Just a reminder, antibiotics, I think we sometimes forget how much they're used in basic procedures, surgeries, transplants, dialysis. And so without antibiotics, these procedures would have a really high failure rate. So by the 1960s, leading scientists and doctors basically declared this one. And we saw a shift towards more lucrative drugs to fight cancer and heart disease. So it goes from being the largest cause of death to basically the smallest cause of death among the leading causes of death. And this sort of feeling around antibiotics, and I think it still exists today, is that there's so much good that has been done by these drugs that we, I think, kind of downplay and forget that these compounds have some very toxic effects as well. So during the same golden era of antibiotic development, you have diseases that come from the antibiotic use. So Gray baby syndrome, which is aplastic anemia, a serious side effect from chloramphenicol, and then pseudomembranous colitis became a commonly recognized complication, reported rates as high as 14 to 27% among postoperative patients. By the end of the 1950s, in addition to seeing the benefits of antibiotics, we also have a pretty good understanding of the toxic side effects of antibiotics. So the golden era of antibiotics is followed by the golden era of C. diff. And so C. diff comes along. We see 1974, this study at Barnes Hospital showed that a specific study where we actually use colonoscopies to evaluate the patients who are exposed to antibiotics, and notice that out of 200 patients given Clinda, diarrhea developed in 42 or 21% of them. 20 clindamycin recipients had 10% of that had pseudomembranous colitis at the time of endoscopy. So in 2017, 250,000 illnesses and 14,000 deaths occurred from C. diff-related infections. So these are not benign compounds. We have 1 in 5 emergency department visits for adverse drug events being related to antibiotics. And the number one adverse drug event ER visit for children under 18 is antibiotic related. The gut microbiome, so this is kind of a fascinating area that's sort of exploding right now in its interest. So our bacterial cells that we have in our GI tract, what we're calling the gut microbiome, outnumber our host cells by about 10 to 1. And the genes that encode for that bacteria outnumber our host genes by a factor of 100 to 1. So we literally have trillions of bacteria and their genes, and to the point where we're actually more microbe than we are human. So I almost started to think of us as just this host platform, and that microbes actually rule the world. They are ubiquitous, they are everywhere, and we're just all hosts where they wage their warfare back and forth. And so we're learning more and more about how the gut microbiome, it plays a pivotal role in both health and disease. There's actually a pretty strong connection between the gut and the brain. And a lot of research is being done on depression, Parkinson's disease, other diseases as a result of the gut microbiome. And a dysbiotic state of the gut microbia is becoming recognized as an environmental factor that interacts with the host metabolism, has a role in obesity, diabetes, atopy, and then of course gut-related IBS and bowel diseases. So along come fecal transplant pills, which are crapsules. So this is a real thing that's used more and more and more. But I think it highlights one of the things that we are sort of underappreciating with antibiotic use. And that is, so we saw a study in 2013 in the New England Journal of Medicine on C. diff was actually stopped early because the fecal transplant was so effective, it was ruled unethical not to give it to everybody in the study. A trial published in Lancet in 2017 found that fecal transplants led to complete remission in 1 out of 4 patients with ulcerative colitis. And a study in JAMA in November 2017 found that for C. diff, in which fecal transplants up to 90% effective Crapsils worked, worked just as well as the fecal transplant verified via colonoscopy. So I read an article on, as I was reading up on this, a gentleman in Australia, for example, and in 2015, he was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. He was a pretty young gentleman, and he's described his days as about 12 episodes of diarrhea a day. He had very little time between the time he felt it and something happened, so he was having accidents all the time. So he went through all these treatments, all the first-line therapy, and very little changed his general symptoms. And then he went to a specialist who gave him Crapsils. And over the course of a few months, those symptoms completely went away. And as of this year, he's 2 years out with absolutely no symptoms. So it sort of applies to it. And his current regimen is 4 Crapsils a day. So again, I think it's sort of the tip of the iceberg about the importance of the microbiome in our bodies and the interactions there, and how even one round of antibiotics, even a mild antibiotic, can affect that microbiome. So, like I said before, we're basically more microbe than we are human. 43% of the body's total cell count is our host cells. The rest are microscopic colonists. We're just this big host platform for microbiomes to wage warfare. As these bacteria get attacked by antibiotics, they selectively code for traits that allow them to survive. This is natural selection of bacteria. And most antibiotic compounds are naturally produced molecules. So the mechanisms by which they fight each other that pass down from generation to generation are called intrinsic resistance. But what we've created with antibiotics is something known as acquired resistance. So acquired resistance is when a bacteria develops some mechanism of fending off the antibiotic. So either one or more or all antibiotic you develop resistance to. In many ways, this ends up being worse than cancer. You have a disease that can be treated by very few things, and in some cases, absolutely nothing. So it can kill you, and it can spread, and spread fairly easily in some cases. So the acquired resistance, and I won't go into this too much here. I just thought it was interesting. One example of acquired resistance is the mechanism known as the efflux pump. And so this came along and appears to be a direct result of antibiotic use, where bacteria develop this pump that essentially chews up and spits out the antibiotic compounds. And it's good enough that it can recognize and expel drugs with completely different structures. So that it can act on multiple antibiotics. So literally an antibiotic or a bacterium can go from being drug susceptible to resistant to 5 or 6 different drugs by acquiring a single gene. So the rise of superbugs. So superbugs have been around forever. The superbugs, as we're defining it here, is a bug that's developed a resistance to an antibiotic. And that started, resistance to antibiotics started the moment the antibiotic started being used. The average time for an antibiotic to have resistance developed to is about 5 years, or within 5 years, it's basically guaranteed that you're going to have resistant organisms to that antibiotic. In hospitals, so 1 in 7 catheter and surgery-related hospital-associated infections can be caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and that number increases to 1 in 4 infections in long-term acute care hospitals, which treat patients who generally are very sick and stay on average more than 25 days. More than 2 million people are infected by superbugs each year, and 23,000 die of their infections. That's based on recent CDC data. I won't go into this in detail. This just gives you a little idea of the numbers. What does this look like? So we hear about these superbugs, but how many are there and what are they doing? So we see one of the scariest ones that come along is the carbapenem resistant, because carbapenem is kind of our big heavy hitting antibiotic that we keep up on the shelf for, you know, major infections, and it's seen as a last resort for many infections. So resistance to this is particularly scary. 9,000 approximately a year, and about 600 people die. 80,000 MRSA, about 11,000 deaths from that. At the bottom, you see drug-resistant gonorrhea, about 246,000 infections a year, and drug-resistant Campylobacter drug-resistant infections per year, about 310,000.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadam, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now, safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance. The TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
It's estimated that if the current trends continue, we could see by 2050, superbugs could kill up to 10 million people a year. And the World Health Organization has named antibiotic resistance as one of the three most important public health threats of the 21st century. There are a lot of causes of antibiotic resistance. We're going to talk in a little more detail here in a minute about the current antibiotic pipeline. So some more examples of superbugs: resistance in Klebsiella pneumonia. It's now popping up in some countries because of this resistance to carbapenem. The antibiotics don't work in more than half of the people treated with Klebsiella pneumonia. Treatment failure as a last resort for gonorrhea, so this is third generation cephalosporins, has been confirmed in at least 10 countries. Recent article in the New York Times, front page, about urinary tract infections. So New York City Department of Health found that a third of uncomplicated UTIs caused by E. coli were now resistant to Bactrim, which is one of our first line drugs for UTIs. And I think this is a really scary fact, one of the most widely used drugs, and at least 20% of them were resistant to five other common treatments. Researchers last year reported in a study that 30% of all UTIs in Britain are resistant to key antibiotics. So resistance to first-line drugs to treat infections caused by Staph aureus is also widespread. So people with MRSA are estimated to be 64% more likely to die than people without the resistant form of Staph aureus. Colistin is the last resort treatment for life-threatening infections caused by, I don't know how to say that, Enterobacterium, which are resistant to carbapenems. Resistance to colistin has recently been detected in several countries and regions, making infections caused by such bacteria untreatable. And as we talked about, the CRE infections, which are particularly scary. We saw a strain of Klebsiella pneumonia resistant to all antibiotics emerge in the U.S. in 2016. So we currently see 80% of gonorrheal infections are now resistant to antibiotics. 440,000 new cases of drug-resistant TB are now appearing annually. So in the not-too-distant future, you can see strep throat or a scraped knee that could kill you, a simple hip replacement that would result in 1 in 6 deaths, and the cost of all this is expected to double. So we kind of made this historic miscalculation where the FDA drug approval process, for all good reasons, became more robust and became a lot more difficult to get a drug approved and a lot more expensive. Currently estimated about $1 billion and about 10 years worth of trials and study to get an antibiotic to market. Antibiotic R&D slowed in the 1960s, and then we had the prominent scientists and doctors doing this victory lap, saying we've taken care of infections, now let's move on to cancer and heart disease. And I think we became more complacent during that time period. We also saw the development of the medical industrial complex to focus more on profit and high producing, high income producing drugs. And then while all this is happening, bacteria is developing more and more resistant mechanisms. So antibiotics just aren't profitable. They're not an enticing investment anymore. The net present value currently estimated for an antibiotic to bring to market, and this is the net present value, is estimated future cash flows minus the current R&D costs and marketing costs, is estimated to be negative $50 million to bring an antibiotic to market. They're used judiciously over short periods of time, and then we know for a fact that resistance will develop to the drug within 5 years. Like I said, currently costs over $1 billion in 10 years of testing. Antibiotics have the highest failure rate among all new drugs, and clinical trials for antibiotics are more complex and costly. A couple quick case studies of big things that have happened that have led to even less interest in investing in antibiotics is the genomic sequencing of Haemophilus influenza. So 1995, the landmark study published the entire genomic sequence for the bacterium Haemophilus influenza. This was met with a lot of fanfare, a lot of interest. Pharmaceutical companies jumped on this. GlaxoSmithKline, for example, spent over $100 million trying to target all these hundreds of genes that they now could see and try to coming up with new antibiotics. About 500,000 compounds were screened by GlaxoSmithKline scientists from 1995 to 2001, but not a single one became useful in humans. So this basically proved to be a huge failure and a huge waste of money, and it caused all the pharmaceutical companies become much more conservative with their investments and interest in antibiotic development. And then a recent sad occurrence is the Achaogen bankruptcy. So Achaogen is a pharmaceutical company. It was founded in 2002. Their only thing that they did was antibiotics. They have one drug, plazomycin is what it's called. It was approved by the FDA in 2018. A lot of people were watching this because the Achaogen really hit all the marks that should have signaled success. They recruited good developers, targeted infection that the World Health Organization considered a critical unmet need. It stuck with its compound for 15 years of testing. It scored several rounds of public investment and private philanthropy, and it got its drug approved. The problem is it got it approved for UTIs, and what they were banking on was to get it approved for bacteremia. And as a result of that, there's much better choices and much cheaper choices for UTIs. They filed for bankruptcy just less than a year later in April of this year. As a result of that, three major pharmaceutical companies have closed their R&D arms for antibiotics. And then currently, if you look at the pipeline, over 90% of antibacterial products in development today are from small companies, and over 60% of those have no other products. It's their only product, with the highest failure rate and the basically the worst profit model out there. So as this pipeline is basically dried up, and I'm not gonna go into these in detail, but there are a lot of ideas being thrown around to try to stimulate investment in antibiotics. Things called push and pull incentives, where you could provide tax breaks to pharmaceutical companies, maybe for existing products, if they promise to invest some of that money into antibiotics. You could have a subscription program like Netflix for hospitals, where they all subscribe to it every month, and that gives them access to certain antibiotics. So there's a lot of ideas being thrown around, but I highlight it to basically point out that we all need to be a lot more vocal about it. And so antibiotic stewardship is one of the things that we can all do to help with this. So that, you know, the next time that you throw Keflex for 7 days on a red rash on someone's leg, thinking that you're just going to be safe, I think you need to remember the big picture with the microbiome in the gut and the potential downside of that, and then this increasing problem that we have. I think we should all be more educated on these incentives that are being offered to companies, and we need to ask policymakers to what's their solution. You know, as people run for different seats, we need to ask them, do you have ideas about the current antibiotic development market? And write letters, and you know, that's starting to happen more with big organizations. Antibiotic use in nursing homes, remember, is inappropriate about 50% of the time, and 20% of providers account for 80% of the antibiotic use. So, and UTIs are probably one of the low-hanging fruits.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadem Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect.